We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this hour of Focus, we will be talking with novelist and poet Rolando Hinojosa Smith. He is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois from Texas, where he lives. He is the Ellen Clayton Garwood Professor at University of Texas at Austin. He was born in South Texas to a family with connections on both sides of the border. And in his writing, he has created a place much like the one where he grew up, a place that he calls Belkin County. And he has now written 15 books set there, has given it a very rich history, a very complicated cast of characters. And we'll talk a little bit about both his love of complicated family stories and also of crime writing, some of which he has done as well. He is visiting the campus to take part in the Carr Reading Series. In fact, he is the first speaker for this semester. It's something of a homecoming for him because he earned his PhD here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign back in 1969. And I do want to mention all the sponsors one time. His reading is co-sponsored by Ninth Letter, the Creative Writing Program, and Department of English, with also support from College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, Department of Latino Studies, and the Department of Spanish, Italian, and Portuguese. Okay, and if you'd like to hear from him, you should stop by the Alina Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4:30 in the author's corner. He'll be giving a reading, and I think that you will enjoy hearing him. And we're very pleased that he could be here on the program, too, to talk. 333-9455 is our number if you'd like to call in with a question, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. Perhaps I am expecting that the place that you have created, Belkin County in Clayle City, is much like the place where you grew up. Tell us about that. What was your home like?
I was born in a farming community of 6,000. Not unlike the Midwest as far as farming is concerned. Mm-hmm. Different crops, of course, but small, rural, but equipped with a very nice public library. And I happen to come from a family of readers. My parents read to each other in English and in Spanish as well. Mm. And I'm the youngest of five. My two older brothers read, and my two older sisters read as well. I thought everybody read. What a big mistake. I dated a girl when I was 16, and there wasn't even a magazine in the house. So I turned out to be a reader, and I loved to read. My first job in the fourth grade was as a librarian, and my 4 years at UT for the baccalaureate degree, I was a librarian at the reserved reading room. So maybe I should be a librarian instead of a writer.
Well, you got your hands on books one way or another.
Absolutely.
And your dad was of Mexican descent.
Mm-hmm. Those Hinojosas were five, three of whom couldn't spell. They omitted the H and began their last name with a Y. They stayed on the southern bank, but it was all owned by the Spanish crown, so it didn't matter. But two of them did cross to the northern bank, and we hail from that. The first census taken by the Spanish crown was in 1750, and that's where we saw the five Hinojosas and the three of whom, as I mentioned, couldn't spell.
Yeah.
They were all related, though. And then all the grants were given there, and each grant, irrespective of size, had the same acreage leading to the river, because it was all irrigation on both banks, the southern bank, which is Mexican now, and the northern bank, which is Texan.
Yeah, so your family, at least on your dad's side, has roots there that go back long before Texas existed as a state.
Mm-hmm. On the Smith side, my grandfather, Abraham Newman Smith, came from northern Mississippi, a county called Jones, which was against secession, by the way. So that Hull County was unloved in northern Mississippi. My grandmother, Martha Phillips, who was also a teacher eventually, came from southern Illinois. But they moved to Texas. And because my grandfather at 12 or 13 had been a drummer boy. So that made him a veteran, although he was probably in the last 8 months of the war or something like that. I was born in 29, and my mother was the youngest of eight, and I'm the youngest of five. So I have a grandfather, now dead, whom I never met, who had been in the Civil War. And he was given a job as a postmaster down in the valley, and they came down with acreage, of course. Yeah.
And the story that I've read is that your dad fought in the Mexican Revolution?
Yes. But that was a brief stint. But what he did mostly was to buy, sell, and trade horses as well. Mm-hmm. With a partner of his, another Texas Mexican, but he lived in South Texas, and we lived in the valley, but that's good range and ranch country as well. Yeah, he was there for a while, but he got out of it, and there were so many sides anyway, but he believed, and then he became an unbeliever because he just said, this is not doing anything for anybody except for the same people.
Yeah. I'm interested in having you talk about how it is that people who live along that border think, and people who have strong connections on both sides, that connections of family, connections of culture that go back a long way, how people think about this business of identity and who they are and what they call themselves.
Yeah, maybe I can use the term intramural. It's a typical border community, whether you're speaking of Kehl in Germany and Strasbourg across the Rhine in France or any other border community or communities. They share a lot, blood, by the way, and they also share a history. And so, therefore, that's just part of the culture, and they share the language. And many of them become bilingual. Not all. The working class probably does not. Mm-hmm. But, say, the educated classes on both sides. And there's a lot of intermarriage also. A lot of the boys and girls that I went to school with married kids from across the river and settled down on one or the other side. There's almost no difference, except, of course, that the citizenship does count for a lot. Mm-hmm. If some of my girlfriends that I knew in high school and married Mexicans, their babies would be born in Brownsville. They would cross the river from Matamoros, or they live in Reynosa. They would go to McAllen General Hospital, and the baby would be born in the States. Mm-hmm. And but that's very typical, too, of border communities. We're so far from D.C., and they are so far from Mexico City, that for years it was an isolated part of the world until Texas came into the Union. Declared independence in 1836, entered the Union on December of 1845. But all this time, it was a typical border community where they rely on each other for trade. We have what they want, and they have what we want. There's also a lot of contraband, of course, which happens in every border combination of two cities, whether it's Belgium, Netherlands, Germany. And they tend to become very intramural, very self-centered, and they think, I should conclude myself, that we're self-sufficient, when we're not, really. But we think we are. And I take a census in one of the classes I teach at UT. That particular class is called Life and Literature of the Southwest. And I take a census, and I ask my students, and where are you from? And they'll say Dallas, Fort Worth, San Antonio, Houston, El Paso. And then the kids from the valley will say, I'm from the valley. And they won't give you the name of the town. And then I ask another one, I'm from the valley. And where are you from? The valley. So then I have to stop the class and I say, I have to break these people down. Where in the valley are you from? And say, Mission, McAllen, Edinburgh, Mercedes, my hometown, wherever. And this is because the valley is a very strong support system and they think of themselves as valleyites. Now, we really are not a valley, right? We're a delta. But now even the Mexicans across the river call themselves El Valle, And we're not a valley, but this is just one side influencing the other. But, it's very strange. We're Texans, but we're from the valley. We're not from up north, as we say, refer to Amarillo and Lubbock as if they were in the Midwest someplace.
Yeah, well, I've heard what they say about Texas. It's a whole nother country.
Yeah, but I think we create our own myths and then we export them. You know? Yeah, mm-hmm. We don't always deliver, though.
Our guest this morning in this hour is Rolando Hinojosa Smith. He's a novelist, essayist, poet. He teaches English at the University of Texas. He's here visiting the campus where he once upon a time got his Ph.D. He's authored a number of books, and as I explained at the beginning, has set them all in a place that he has invented, a place called Belkin County, which is right on the in South Texas on the border with Mexico. And has created this very complicated, very long history and of the place and filled it full of people. One of the things that I read was that someone apparently sat down and counted the number of characters that you created and came up with 1,000? 1,000 characters?
Yeah, you could probably guess the nationality, too. It was a German. Those people are amazing. He did. Not only that, of course, he listed them, and then in parentheses he would put initials of the novels in which they appear. Some appear in one, some in four, some in three, and it goes back and forth. I mean, that is really true scholarship of some sort, and it's bound to help, and it probably does help other scholars who have written their doctoral theses on me or on the work and or the masters. But the other, his name is Wolfgang Karrer, and he was a prof at Osnabrück University. Mm-hmm. And he was kind enough to send it to me. When I got wind of this, I wrote him, and we became great friends, by the way. And he stays with me. When he and his wife come over, I'll stay with them. But yeah, he did. And every time I come up with a novel and I do have some new characters, I say, well, you have to buy this one, or I'll send it to you, Wolf. And
so you can add them to the list.
Of course, a lot of non-fictional characters there as well, a lot of historical figures, but he includes them as well because they're mentioned there. Yeah.
So I gather that when you started out writing, you really didn't have in mind that you would be creating this saga, but that you did want to write a multi-character drama?
What I wanted to do, and I did with the first one, which I wrote in Spanish, titled it Estampas del Valle, and then someone did a translation as The Valley, or The Sketches of the Valley. Mm-hmm. I then did the translation myself in 83, and it was published. What I wanted to do, I didn't want to write a 19th century novel, a linear novel. It begins with A, ends at Z, and then you can stop in the middle of the dream. With exposition, all these things you can do with a novel. I wanted to show the people as the protagonist and who live in one place and have lived in one place. And that was it. But after that one, and I won a prize, I wrote a second one, which is also fragmentary and dynamic. People thought they were just vignettes or short stories. And I said, no, it's about one people, one culture, one place. It's a novel. Well, finally they came around. After the second novel, I said, I think I'm going to get away from this, but stay within it and want to show other experiences of the Texas Mexicans in the world. So I wrote Korean Love Songs, which shows servicemen. And I didn't want to write a novel for that one. I didn't want to write He Said, She Said. So I wrote verse. I'm no poet, unfortunately, but it's a narrative form. It's in verse, and it's worked. Been translated into German also and other part. And after that third one, I said, well, I think I've got a series in my hand. So before the publisher, when he accepted it, I wrote him back. This is before email. I'd have gotten right away to him, but I had to wait a week or two and wrote him back. And I said, when you publish this, I would very much want you to put Clail City Death Trip series. He said, trap? No, I said trip. I said, we're in a death trip. All of us, you know, we start dying as soon as we're born. He said, oh, okay. I said, you are going to do it, right? He said, oh, yeah, I'll do it. I said, thank you. And he did. You know, it was very friendly. But he said, you're going to write a series? I said, I'm committed. I've got three novels about the same people. I kill some off and I give birth to others. Yeah.
Well, I definitely wanted to ask you about what the Clail City Death Trip series, that what exactly you meant by that. So now I guess the idea is, well, you know, a life story.
That's it. Yeah, a whole bunch of people. Very interesting characters, some of them. You mentioned prior to our conversation here, Becky.
Yes.
Yeah. I started writing Becky and her friends. It's a what-if novel. I didn't know that the genre existed, but I asked myself in English, what would happen if a woman who's 39 years old, middle class, college educated, a very prominent family in this small town, and Roman Catholic, what if she decides that her husband isn't going to live with her anymore? What are the ramifications of all of this? So I toyed with that for a while. Mm-hmm. Started in Spanish, hit a stone wall after 7 months, laid it aside, went to Iraq in 89 to set up an American lit curriculum. And when I was there, I got the idea, I said, why don't I just write Becky in English? Yeah, that'd be a good idea. Came back home, started teaching again in the fall. And I said, this is all wrong. I have a narrator. I don't need a narrator. I don't want to use a first-person point of view. And I don't want to use the third. It won't work. So I had every character. There must be 30-odd, very odd characters,
yes.
Some of them.
Yes.
And they're the ones that tell the story. Some are for her action, some are against, and for whatever reasons. But so I was out of it. The only one who shows up who isn't a character is the writer, who is known as the Rye. And he does an interview. He just comes in. He's from the hometown. He's well-known. And he asks, what do you think about Becky's actions? And they talk. Well, you've read the book.
This is a novel, Becky and Her Friends.
And Her Friends.
And it really is it takes this unusual form. One chapter, one character, their voice. And as you say, it's very gossipy. And it's as if you were going around town and you picked particular people and said, oh, well, tell me, what do you think about this thing with Becky and the divorce? And then so that person tells you what it looks like from their perspective, ends up also, I think, telling you a lot about themselves, about the town. So you end up learning a lot more about the town and the person, and also some about Becky and her situation with her ex and her new husband and so forth. And it's very entertaining.
Thank you very much. You put your finger right on it. It's exactly the way it came out. But it has to do with writing, and you're always asked, where do you get your ideas? Well, I don't know where I get my ideas. And when did you first start to write? Well, since I was a child, that type of thing. But they're sincere in their questions, so I try not to be, you know, haughty about it, and I'm not. But Becky was a challenge. And then I wrote it in Spanish again. And the narrators themselves the voices were by these people. But you really pegged it well, and that's... It's gossipy. No one can stay on subject more than a minute or two, and then they come back to it. And we do it all the time.
I'm sure very much just like what it would be if you went to some small town where everybody knew everybody else's business.
Oh, God.
And you started them talking about their neighbors or their friends or people they liked or they didn't like. And then that's what you'd get, this sort of rambling sort of story with little bits about everything all mixed in.
Yeah. Gossip is a good term that you use, and that's exactly what it is.
Do you generally now mostly write the story first in Spanish?
I did it with the first two, and then I did them in English. I did not do the translation of one, but I had to work very carefully with a translator because she just did not know that much Spanish, I'm afraid. Hmm. Yeah. The reason I switched almost completely to English, except for the short pieces, I still write essays in Spanish and short stories in Spanish, set there or set elsewhere, but using both languages. And it's mostly English now because that's where the market is. And the publisher, the main publisher for my work, Arte Público Press at University of Houston, said, you know, I think we better go with English. I said, but what if it comes out in Spanish? Well, I'll publish that too. I said, well, okay. And he does. He's very good. I've a reprint of the very first detective story. I noticed in the 80s, and this was not in the newspapers, but living in the Valley and being from there and going back and forth from the university to visit my family, I noticed of the violence that was not getting any play whatsoever except in the Valley, not in Texas, not in New York or L.A. But I wrote about the violence in a novel called Partners in Crime. The partners in crime are the cops who chase the criminals themselves, you know. So those are all the partners. And then 13 years later, and you have Ask a Policeman, mm-hmm. and the violence increases. But that was in 98, and there was still no national. Now, of course,
now it's
there
a big story, and yeah. we read about it and you hear about
so now
violence.
So now the publisher wants to, and he will republish, reprint Partners in Crime in November. It's coming out in November, along with another book called, and I'm hesitating because I call it in my own voice or in a voice of my own, and I don't remember the title anymore. I'll be surprised when I...
This was the essay, personal...
It's a bunch of essays, a few short stories, articles, but it's mostly some longish articles about the Rio Grande Valley. Mm.
I did indeed read these books and found them... I enjoyed reading them very much. Ask a Policeman is a police procedural, so it is a crime mm-hmm. novel of that style of writing, which tends to be kind of matter of fact, much like real police work is. Although I was talking with some writers yesterday, in fact, who'd written a detective novel, have written some detective novels set in Africa. And I said something like, well, for me, the test is there some point at which you can't stop reading? Where you're so caught up in the story, you say you must keep on, so you know what the windup is. You know, so I think it's interesting. There's some point at which a story, if the right things are happening, then it gains so much momentum that it will not let go of you. And certainly, Ask a Policeman is true.
I think that an experienced reader, and you are, and many young college men and women also. If after the first 25 pages you're not grabbed, you might as well put that book down.
Yeah.
I was a Pulitzer Prize judge, that horrible day back in 2001. I was up in Maine reading the manuscripts. Huh. And there were three of us. Steve Wasserman from the L.A. Times and Dick Ader from the New York Times, and I was representing the Midwest, I guess, being down in Texas. And after the first 25, 30, sometimes 40 pages, I'd say, we're not going anywhere here. But now we had email, thank goodness, and I said, hey, guys, this is what I'm doing. He said, no, don't worry, you're on the right track. You cannot afford to read everything. Although they give us about 9 to 10 months. It's a whole number of books, but they do give you ample time. And I said, yeah, after about 25 pages, you can more or less tell. Then you say, I have to finish. So all three of us would finish some books, but we wouldn't vote for them, but they were just so readable.
Yeah.
I'm not telling any stories after school here. This happened a long time ago. The awards have been done. The woman that I chose for number one, they voted for number two. The one I chose for number two, they voted for number one. That's how close
we were. Well, at least you were close.
Isn't that amazing, though? Yeah. I wrote them back, and then they answered back and said, this is terrific, you know, that they were so tight. Yeah, they were. That was a great experience, by the way, but also taught me to tell my creative writing kids, don't feel guilty if you can't finish this book. There's something wrong there.
That reminds me of once, I'm sure you know Philip Graham on the English faculty here, and we were doing programs where he would come on and we'd just talk about what we'd been reading. And at one point he did say something like he gave us all permission if we started reading a book and it just didn't do it for us. He said, we gave us all permission to stop. He said, you do not have to, just because you've started reading it does not mean that you have to finish that book. If it's not doing it for you, find something else. There are plenty of books to read.
That's sound advice. It is. Yeah.
Going back to the English Spanish thing. You grew up speaking both English and
absolutely
Spanish.
Yeah.
Have there been particular points where maybe perhaps one or the other language really took precedence?
It would, and it did during World War II. My two older brothers, they're both in the Pacific, and my two sisters had married. And so it was just my dad, mom, and me. And they would send me off to northern Mexico, to Saltillo, which is the capital of the state of Coahuila, which is as high as Denver. So you can imagine the climate in the summertime, escaping the Texas heat.
That was wonderful.
Oh, it was marvelous. He had a huge pool with some of the coldest water I've ever been in because it would come straight from the mountain. Mm-hmm. And I had to speak Spanish every waking moment. I did so at home, but English would come in, Spanish would come in. I would mix both languages. But there, in a village of 1,200, I was the only English speaker. We had one baker, one pharmacist, who warned you as you came in. There was a sign that said, "I practice without a license." Ejerzo sin título, you know. And we had a church, but no parish. We had a mission priest who would bury and marry people, and you'd see him again a month or whenever it was, and it was great. And then I would take the bus and go to Saltillo, the capital city, to an Athenaeum, El Ateneo Fuente. And, of course, Spanish was the order of the day. And so for those summers, you're in the 40s, when my brothers were overseas and Mom and Dad would ship me off over there, it was marvelous. Now I'd come back just fluent as all get out. Not that I had any fear or danger of losing it, but it was just being in Spanish all the time. And then, of course, having to revert back to English after a while. Mm. But my mom, who also taught, as did my grandmother, whom I mentioned earlier, her Spanish was perfect also. And Dad, of course, being an American citizen, spoke English, but from an old Spanish background.
Yeah. I was interested in the one of your earlier comments about how you were trying to write something. Maybe it was Becky and her friends, where you said you had, perhaps it was one of the other books, where essentially you said you had started writing it in Spanish, and that somehow it just didn't work, and so you changed to English, and somehow there. It did. What was the difference?
I wish I knew, because I was sailing along. I'd put in some 7 or 8 months with Los Amigos de Becky. That's what I'd called it. And then I hit this stone wall that I mentioned. I just couldn't go on. And you sit there and you sweat and you say, okay, it's going to come out at something. No, and I devoted all that time. So I just said, I'm going to lay this aside. Mm. And then that's when the Department of State and asked me to go to set up an American literature curriculum. And it's in Mosul, northeast Iraq, which is really Nineveh. And then I said, when I was there by myself, the only English speaker, except for the professors at Mosul University, I said, why don't I just write this in English and maybe something will happen? And I did. So then I went back to the Spanish one. But it was, it's a mystery still that I just couldn't go on. It was, You can't force yourself anyway, and if you do, then it doesn't come out right. So,
we're talking this morning in this hour with Rolando Hinojosa Smith. He's a novelist, essayist, poet. He teaches English at University of Texas. Is here visiting here. We'll give a reading this afternoon. We'll tell you more about that in just a second. We'll take a short break here. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Will Arnett. He co-starred in Arrested Development as Job, and on 30 Rock, he played Jack's rival, Devin Banks. Now Arnett is starring in the new comedy series Up All Night about a sleep-deprived couple adjusting to their new lives as parents. And we'll hear from two neuroscientists who've written a new book about how a child's brain develops. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here during the week. We have different programs for you every week. We try to put some variety in the program, and if you'd like to see the schedule, what we'll be doing in the days ahead, the easiest thing to do is go to our website, will.illinois.edu. That way you also may listen to past programs that you might have missed first time around. In this hour, we're talking with Rolanda Hinojosa-Smith. He teaches English at University of Texas at Austin. He's authored a number of books. He's also written poetry and written essays. He has some connections here to the University of Illinois. He earned his Ph.D. here in 1969 and has taught a variety of other places. He's here visiting to take part in the Carr Reading Series. This brings writers to the campus so that young writers here can talk with them about the work of writing. And when they're here, they always do a reading. And he, in fact, will be doing reading this afternoon at 4:30 at the Author's Corner at the Illini Union Bookstore. So if you'd like to stop by, you should. And also, you can go to the bookstore, to the library, wherever you go for books, and look for his books. And you could certainly find the two that we've talked a little bit about, Becky and Her Friends and Ask a Policeman, and there are a number of others. And if there are folks who are listening and would like to call in, of course, you can do that too. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a bit earlier about the fact that you have created many characters, big cast of characters there in Clail City. How I can say from reading Becky and Her Friends that you have managed to give them distinct individual voices. When you have that many characters, though, how do you do that? I mean, how do you come up with voices for characters?
I don't know. And I'm not being cute here. I just put myself as if I were a woman of 70 years of age or 40 years of age, two different cultures because of the different ages and different stages in life, as well as whatever part of society they form. And when I'm a very old man or a very young man or a middle-aged man, I just try to go back and say, how would I behave at this age? And what would be my state of mind regarding this woman who is well known, et cetera, et cetera. But I really don't know. I just, that's why I didn't want to use the first or third person point of view. I wanted to be the character, whether male, female, woman, rather age or young, old, it didn't matter. I don't know.
Can you hear these people? Do you hear them speaking to you?
When I write, because these are all monologues, as you well know, I was voicing as I was writing. And then when I went back to the rewriting, you don't really rewrite what you do. You edit, you take out a word, take out a page or whatever. Or you may just come back with the original word because it sounds better now. Mm-hmm. But I can hear myself that way. And it's a big help. And then when I'm through and I'm finished with that chapter or whatever, then I will read it, and I want to hear myself. Am I speaking the truth here? Is this really the way this person would talk about this person, or express herself or express himself? And if I'm satisfied, then I'll keep it. Otherwise, I'll go back to the table and start tapping on that computer again and see what happens.
Well, I'd like to give people an opportunity to hear you read. Would you?
Yes, let me
do a little reading for us.
This is a very brief thing. It's a monologue, and it's about one of the many experiences of many Texas Mexicans who still do, but not in as large numbers, of migrant farm laborers who would leave South Texas, would leave the Valley and other places of the state, and come to work in Illinois, in Hoopston, or Akron, or go pick tomatoes in Findlay, Ohio, or pickles or rather cucumbers in Pinconning, Michigan. And I would hear stories about their travels. So this is an old man, and it's a monologue. And I won't read the entire thing because it's very long. But it's, my name is Fructuoso Alanis Garcia, and I was so named for my saint's day, the 21st day of January. In English, according to my granddaughter Lucia, my name means bountiful, productive. Myself, I find it proper that one so named should be chosen to work the land, to know it and to give it life, so that it, the land, return part of that life in grain and cereal and vegetables, yes, in fruits of labor and of bounty to that person who prepared the land and watched the crops grow from nothing but a hope and a handful of seeds. When I work my land, the one I own, I work it the same way I work somebody else's land. It makes no difference, none, really. Land is land, and when all is said and done, or as we say, when the music is over, one leaves the terrain, el terreno, for somebody else to occupy. But one must leave the land clean, weeded, and ready for that somebody else who comes to it with that hope and that handful of seeds I spoke of.
Mm. That's very nice. That's very nice. I think that you do certainly get in your writing, I think you do get a real definite sense of place. And of people's attachment to place and of the way that people feel that their identity, who they are, is really formed by the place where they live.
I wrote an essay called This Writer's Sense of Place in 1983, which was celebrating the 100th anniversary of the University of Texas. And they had asked me to write something. They had asked other writers as well. And I said, well, I'm a Texan. You know, what should I write about? And I said, I'm going to write about what I know and where I'm from. So I put this writer's sense of place. And mm-hmm. then the thing wrote itself on this one. It just flowed. And well, there's a lot of editing because there's a lot of extraneous stuff all the time. But that was the easiest writing I had to do. And I said, gosh, I wish you were like this all the time. And it worked. And it's mm-hmm. been reprinted here and reprinted there because it's a sort of model of what happens when you're born and you begin to contribute to the culture of that place as sort of a payback because you've taken so much of the culture into yourself from that place. So, I think the word sense is what captures it. It's the writer's sense of place. It's not what I know or anything. It's just I have a sense for the place yeah. and the people in it and yeah. what they do.
It just it certainly seems, I'm sure that there are many ways in which the place forms people's character, but I think, and I sense at least your characters feel such a strong attachment to the place and that they still, even though some of these people and their families have been there for a long time, there still seems to be some remnant of pioneer spirit and that thing that says, well, if your family's only been here 100 years, you're still the new kid.
Yeah. It's the isolation too. To the east we have the Gulf of Mexico, and if you go north of the valley you have the King Ranch with its 970,000 acres of ranch land. Mm-hmm. If you go west, that's where the mountains start, and then if you go south, well, you're in a foreign country. It's Mexico. So the Valleyites, and even the Valley Mexicans who from across the river, that's why they look to each other. I mean, this is our little, we're 900 miles, if you go by the river, from El Paso all the way down to the Gulf. So that's a very distinct place. And we have a lot of Midwesterners go there beginning in October to escape the harsh winters here, and then they leave around late March or the first week of April. So they go down there, and you mm-hmm. see Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa plates all the time. And I have a sense of place because when I see them, I say, well, I lived in the Midwest for a while. Because I taught in Minnesota, that's another 4 years, and my five here in Illinois. And you just develop a sense for the place. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I married a Midwesterner, too, so that cured me right there. You know, all right. She was a Michigan grad, yeah.
Well, there's you find two places that about as different as you can possibly imagine, Minnesota and Texas. I think you're dealing with some fairly extreme poles.
My goodness. We've had, I think, over 70 days of three-digit degree weather.
Yeah.
You know, a Minnesotan would not last down there. But I don't know.
You we talked very in the very very beginning. You talked about how, from the point where you were young, you were a reader, and all your families were readers, yeah. And that you read all sorts of things. But I think at least that I read that maybe you did have a particular sort of fondness for mystery stories, detective fiction, crime writing.
When I was writing the series, and I want to present the place and the people. And then when I noticed the violence that I mentioned in Partners and then later on in Policeman, yeah. 13 years later, all of that reading that I had done as a young man and as a boy, aside from reading classics, of course, in all languages, whatever I could, I enjoyed very much the detective story. the suspense, the thriller, the mystery. But I preferred the procedural. How do the cops do this? How do they get into it? What is it that they do? And what procedures do they follow? And I also like the idea that the reader would have more information than the policeman, as easily happens in procedurals, as you know. But I only put them there in the series, not because they were detective stories, but for two reasons. First, I wanted the younger Mexican-Americans to be able to see that you could write about anything because you lived in this area or that area. It wasn't restricted to the migrant farm laborers. That novel was written by Tomas Rivera, and it can't be topped. It's really just outstanding. But I wanted to show the Texas Mexican in every sphere, upper class, middle class, working class. And my characters are they populate all different classes, you know. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to show them in the Army or in grad school, but also to show the writers and the upcoming writers, look, I said, you can use the prose fiction. It's so flexible. And the word, if you go etymologically, it's novel, which means new, and anything is worth it. So the fragmentary novel, the dynamic novel, that Korean love songs, which is in verse, and then the detective stories. The last one I wrote aboard a container ship. I took a 35-day trip on a container ship, took paperbacks, books way too much, so I took paperbacks. But these were old friends, books I had read many times. Mm-hmm. And I wrote an academic novel because I asked myself, we don't have an academic novel in our literature. So I wrote We Happy Few. Yeah. And it's a great title because it comes from William Shakespeare, as you well know, and as the listeners here also know. And that was a lot of fun, too. Some of the students are very retro. They occupy the president's office 20 years after these things are happening in California and elsewhere. And it's a very chatty one, too. The faculty occupies a good portion of the conversations, mm-hmm. and it's mostly gossip, half-truths that they don't know. See, I've been a chair a few times, but I've also been a dean of College of Liberal Arts and a small school. Then I became a VP for Academic Affairs. So I was able to see budgets. I was able to see a more generalized picture, and as well as a specialized picture of the academy. And I wrote it longhand. I went back to longhand because I didn't want to take my computer with me. And I didn't want to be burdened with a lot of stuff. I was going to be gone 35 days and nights. We hit Tokyo and four Chinese cities and got to walk around and, you know, look at the milieu and all that. But they didn't make me an expert on anything. But then I would come back and I would write. And write I did, and I had a great time writing it.
And so you wrote that essentially, I'm sure there was a lot of revising. Essentially, though, you wrote the book in a month?
Because it was 35 days, about 30 days exactly.
Yeah.
But that was, it was a great room. I had my own shower, my own toilet, my own bed, beautiful desk, and the portholes are not really portholes. They're square windows, but terrific for viewing. And I just sat down and wrote and took a lot of paper, a lot of pencils. I took spirals. I wrote it in a spiral notebook. And when I wasn't staring out at the sea, watching the birds just floating or watching this, I never did see a whale. I'll go see the tails and then the spray that comes out. And 5, 6, 7, 8 hours. And then I would ask for a break. I'd call up, may I come up to the bridge, please? And they'd always say yes, but as a courtesy, I would call. I'd go up there and look around and have a good time. And officer would say, you want to go to the engine room? Yes, I want to go to the engine room.
Of course.
See everything.
Sure.
You know? And I wanted to see what the protocol was in eating. I had my own table as a paying guest, then the senior officers, then the junior officers, and across the way, the crew. That was considered a small, according to the captain, a small container, 657 containers, those massive things. But Hyundai, which we call Hyundai, the car manufacturer, they make everything too. They also have ships, have one that carried over 2,000 containers. I saw it in Hong Kong.
Wow.
God, it was amazing. But I was trapped, and I wanted to be trapped, and I said, this is the best place for me to write. And no phone calls. Well, the occasional email to one of my daughters and to my son to let him know where I was or what I was doing. Mm-hmm. It was great. And it was cheap. I'm going to give you the price. It was $3,500. He goes, that's a lot of money. Not for 35 days and nights.
Well, considering it's transportation and accommodation both.
And food, excellent food, Indian food. And I had to be very careful because I think I gained about 8 pounds in a week or something like that. Uh-huh. And I said, oh, no. I'm going to start pulling away from the table because I love Indian food anyway, uh-huh. And it was fine. It was just lovely. And then when I came back, I spent 2 or 3 days in Vancouver, which is a gorgeous town anyway. And then I went home. But I had my manuscript, and I said, I can hardly wait to get my mitts on you again.
What is there a big difference in the result that you get or the experience in writing when you're writing at longhand as compared to writing on the computer?
Yes. The first three works, I think, I did longhand. And then you can look at this finger, and it kind of bent out of shape. Then my daughter taught me how to do 20 functions on a computer, a very small little back in the 80s. And I decided that when I would print a page, the ink was very black, the paper was very white, and it looked beautiful. I said, but don't be fooled. You're going to have to edit these things. Mm-hmm. And I did. And what I loved about handwriting, and I still do, and I'm glad I wrote We Happy Few, you're closer to the work physically as well as mentally when you're writing and you pause and you write the word out and then another word follows in the sentence and then you come up with a paragraph. And I don't know, you're closer to it somehow. But the computer is also a big help because now you can erase and change and paste and cut. They also taught me how to do all those things. It's a good thing to have two whiz kids in a family. That's why I loved when I wrote We Happy Few, because it gave me the opportunity to go back and write again. And it was good.
Yeah. So I understand also that we're bouncing around here, going back to crime, that you have written or are working on a novel that expands on a character that you created, that you wrote a story about. This was the man who was the former police officer who becomes a hitman.
How did you know that?
Oh, I'm sure I read about it somewhere.
Oh, Lord.
Nice climate, Miami. That was the story, and it was put into a collection of Latino crime writing. And then I thought for sure I read somewhere that you actually have now or will have a book with that character.
I have 7 chapters in Spanish, by the way, which I'm now going to put into English, and it'll be 14 chapters, so I think it'll make for a book. And he's an interesting guy. His name is Timothy Matthew O'Hara, a typical Irish New York cop from Long Island, but stationed in Chinatown. His marriage, as happy as it was too short. It was only 15 years. But she was the granddaughter of a capo. No, not of a capo, of a just a bad man at a very early age, and who told him when he came to ask for the girl's hand in marriage, the old-timey, the old man said, your grandfather never took a bribe, your father never took a bribe, and you won't. You know what? You'll never rise above lieutenant. And he didn't.
Honest man, never going to get anywhere in this world.
And in that great city. So he retires at after 20 years, and he becomes somebody else. He adopts the last name of Rienzi, an Italian name, and he becomes a hitter. And his life is one of mobile phones or cell phones that he destroys as soon as a conversation is over. That Nice Climate Miami was an anthology, I believe, by a police woman, Sarah Cortez, who's also a writer, and she publishes, and she writes crime novels. Mm-hmm. So now I've got one. I have the seven already in Spanish, and I'm finished one in English. So I have the other six cut out for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a very different world to set your story.
Now, I wanted to get away from Calais for about a year or two, you know, and then let it build up again. And I said it, well, I know New York, and I love that city also. But you also have to rely on memory for people that you've met. The name Rienzi, we'll talk about it because it would take too long here. But I was calling my wife, Patty, my girlfriend at the time. And I misdialed, and I got Detroit, but I got an old man, a retired man. And I said, I'm very sorry, sir. I don't mean to bother you, but I misdialed, and I got you. And I have a good friend who lives here. So where are you calling from? I said, New Mexico. New Mexico. And I couldn't get him off the line. But it was an enjoyable talk.
This was Mr. Rienzi?
It was Mr. Rienzi.
Oh, so you kept that
name. Yeah, I kept that name.
Kept that name, figured, oh, one of these days I'm going to do something with it.
And I did. The first name, and I've known a lot of kids in the Army who are, you know, Joe Pardi and Sal Petruccio, but I got old Mr. Rienzi.
Mr. Rienzi. Well, long live Mr. Rienzi will now live.
Yeah.
He will never perish.
And he gets away with it.
There's something appealing about that. I'm not exactly sure. Maybe it's that little corner of our spirit that wishes we could get away with things, and it's somehow kind of satisfying.
It's sort of like a payback. He wasn't rewarded as a policeman, so nice. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop because we have used the time for the show. For folks who are listening to us here in Champaign-Urbana, in and around Champaign-Urbana, our guest Rolando Hinojosa-Smith will be giving a reading. This is the first in the car reading series for 2011 for this fall, sponsored by the Creative Writing Program of the Department of English, and brings writers here so they can meet with students, and that just anybody who would like to meet them can do that. So you can stop by this afternoon, 4:30, at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. He'll be there. You can meet him, say hello, you can buy some books, and certainly anywhere you are, go to the library, go to the bookstore, and look for some books. You might try reading Partners in Crime, Ask a Policeman, Becky and Her Friends. You can look for some of the other books by our guest, Rolando Hinojosa-Smith. He is the Ellen Clayton Garwood Professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Will now live.
Yeah.
He will never perish.
And he gets away with it.
There's something appealing about that. I'm not exactly sure. Maybe it's that little corner of our spirit that wishes we could get away with things, and it's somehow kind of satisfying.
It's sort of like a payback, since he wasn't rewarded as a policeman, so nice.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop because we have used the time for the show. For folks who are listening to us here in Champaign-Urbana, in and around Champaign-Urbana, our guest Rolando Hinojosa-Smith will be giving a reading. This is the first in the car reading series for 2011 for this fall, sponsored by the Creative Writing Program of the Department of English, and brings writers here so they can meet with students, and that just anybody who would like to meet them can do that. So you can stop by this afternoon, 4:30, at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. He'll be there. You can meet him, say hello, you can buy some books, and certainly anywhere you are, go to the library, go to the bookstore, and look for some books. You might try reading Partners in Crime, Ask a Policeman, Becky and Her Friends. You can look for some of the other books by our guest, Rolando Hinojosa-Smith. He is the Ellen Clayton Garwood Professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
WILL programs are made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn offers programs designed to support residents' health and independence and to help them feel secure in their environment. More information is available at 384-0100.
And that's it for us here on Focus this morning. Next thing we have up for you is an update on the commodity markets. And with those numbers, here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Dave, and good afternoon, everyone. Let's go right on out to the marketplace where December wheat in Kansas City is trading at 7.94¾, down 7¾ at the board. September wheat at 7.02, up 13¼. March of 2012, though, 7.37¾, up 3/4. September corn, 7.14½, up 5½. and then a bit of red numbers there on December, down one at 722, March down one at 735.5, the May down one at 742.75. Go out to next July, also down one at 746. September soybeans trading 1383.75, up 2.5. The November at 1382.75, down nine. January 1394, down 8.5. March 1399.5, down 10. May 1404.75, down 8. And July of 1412.25, down 7.5. September soybean meal 357.90 is up 60 cents, while the October is 357.70, down 30 cents. September soybean oil 56.90, down 26. The October 56.89, down 38. December live cattle 120.47.5, up 87.5. December live cattle's up 4 bits. It's up 50 cents at 120.25. September feeders 136.